From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Imagine being a youngster in the fight of your life against cancer, or the parent of such a child, and learning the medicine your doctor says would help is not available. This happens a lot. Holly Cam Wall's teenage son David is being treated for leukemia. She describes how they've had to cope with inadequate doses of certain drugs, including an essential pain reliever. Pediatric oncologist Dr. Yoram Ungaru has been raising the alarm about medication shortages for years. He says it's getting worse.
This is about money. The U.S. owns these drug shortages. Shortages do happen in other countries, but not nearly to the extent or the degree that they happen here. And it's because of our healthcare system and the way that drugs are reimbursed and paid for.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Each year in the U.S., more than 15,000 children age 19 and younger are diagnosed with cancer. It's stunning that 5 out of 6 of those kids will be cured. Most of the drugs that bring those cures are not new. Some are decades old, no longer under patent, and hundreds of those drugs are in short supply, often not available when children need them. Dr. Yoram Ungaru, a pediatric oncologist at the Children's Hospital at Sinai, has been raising the alarm about medical shortages for years. He says it's getting worse, and he's here with us. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Nice to be back.
How bad are these shortages?
They're bad, Sheila. As you appreciated, the shortages never go away. Although they peaked several years ago and they drop down sometimes, they always tend to spike back up. As of March 31st of this year, which is the last quarterly data that we have, 276 active drugs in short supply here in the U.S.
What kind of drugs?
So that's what's really remarkable about these shortages. Although I'm a pediatric oncologist, it doesn't just affect the patients I care for. These drug shortages don't discriminate. They include chemotherapy drugs, antibiotics, critical care drugs, essential electrolytes and minerals, normal saline, that's salt water. That's in short supply. So it doesn't matter what kind of a patient or physician or clinician you are, you'll be impacted by these shortages.
In your view, from your practice, from what you see, what's the impact of these shortages?
These shortages are broad in their effect. They cause delays in treatment. They affect patients' lives directly. They cause increased medication errors, inferior outcomes, and they've even been attributed to causing patient deaths. So the impact of these shortages are broad and diverse.
Including deaths.
Including deaths.
Because you wrote in March in the pediatric edition of the Journal of the American Medical Association, quote, "It is likely that numerous children had their anti-cancer treatment compromised by these shortages," close quote. So is it likely then that children who could have been cured were not?
So that's a wonderful question. Capturing this data is not easy. We know from 2 national surveys of pediatric oncologists as well as clinical pharmacists in 2015 and then a separate survey in 2017 that 66%, 2/3 of pediatric oncologists stated that their patients' care was directly impacted by these shortages. Now, through yeoman's work of clinicians across the country, largely in pharmacy departments, many times at the last moment, people are able to scrounge and maybe find enough drug. So it's kind of hard to get accurate data, but we know that patients' care is certainly affected by these shortages.
You wrote about shortages of chemotherapy drugs and supportive care medications. I want to pull into the conversation someone who has had to learn about supportive care agents. Holly Cam Wall's 16-year-old son, David, is being treated by Dr. Ungaru for leukemia. Holly, thanks for coming in to talk to us.
Thank you.
Tell us how David's cancer was found and when.
David's diagnosis started with a lacrosse injury. He injured his back and encountered a lot of pain, which led me to take David to a
orthopedist,
who did an x-ray and was not satisfied with those results due to the amount of pain he was in, and sent him for an MRI, which then resulted in seeing multiple lesions along his spine, which brought me to Dr. Ungaro at Sinai Hospital.
And that was in 2016?
Correct.
When did you start learning about shortages?
Pretty much right at the beginning of his treatment. We were impacted directly, specifically through the support medications needed. Given the intense treatment protocols, there's a high need for additional support medications, whether it's IV antibiotics, nausea medications, or things to directly relieve pain for side effects such as mouth sores.
So tell me about one.
One significant impact that we had due to the shortages was related to just that mouth sores that were created due to the chemotherapy given to David. So when I say mouth sores, I don't mean a canker sore. I mean that basically the skin is virtually removed from the lips, inside of the mouth, the gums. Extremely painful, and it ended up hospitalizing him for several weeks. And he encountered this more than once as a side effect of the medication. And the pain is so severe that even narcotics and opioids that they were administering him would not touch the pain that he was in. So there was one medication that did give him relief. It was a lidocaine rinse that he would swish around in his mouth that would topically ease some of the pain. However, that lidocaine was not available. Sinai did a great job of calling several other area pharmacies to obtain the lidocaine rinse, and they were able to obtain a small amount of it. However, David was not able to take the full dosing.
Is this an expensive drug, this
lidocaine
rinse?
It is not.
What was your reaction to knowing that there was something that could ease David's pain that you couldn't get much of?
It was appalling, to say the least. When you're dealing with a child who is going through such severe treatments and already very sick, and to encounter severe side effects due to that treatment and not to be able to access something so simple as this lidocaine rinse was disturbing. I have what I would consider one of the best healthcare plans you can buy. So access to medications and care was not a concern. It was not even something that if I offered funds to pay directly would have been provided. And so that was a little concerning. There was absolutely no control as a parent to provide him the medication he needed.
That's Holly Kamwal here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Her son David is going through 39 months of chemotherapy for leukemia. They've had to cope with shortages of some medications. Also here is Dr. Yoram Ungaro, a pediatric oncologist at the Children's Hospital at Sinai in Baltimore and a faculty member at the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Ungaro, how do you talk to parents of your patients when there's a shortage?
I'm honest and I'm transparent and I talk to them. And I mean, I have, unfortunately, hard talks with kids and patients about diagnoses and treatments and when relapse or recurrence happens, which doesn't happen often, but it does, that's unpleasant. But talking about a preventable topic like a drug shortage, and Holly put it aptly, the typical response is one of kind of quiet and then appalling shock and awe. And I think we don't, as a profession and as a group, physicians in general, hospitals in general, do a good enough job of informing patients. We know that. We know that from data that hospitals don't want to always let people know. But it's not the hospital's problem. It's not our fault. But I think Holly's point about the supportive care shortages is, if I may, just to digress one moment, drug shortages, as we spoke about, affect every patient and every type of patient. But pediatric oncology is the bellwether. So it's not just chemotherapy shortages, but it's all the drugs that go around. So Kali gave the example of David, who's a trooper. So David got chemotherapy. The drug that caused his mouth sores, methotrexate, has been in short supply. But for me to be able to safely give David methotrexate, I need another drug, a rescue medicine called leucovorin. Well, if you look on the American Society of Health Systems pharmacist shortage list right now, leucovorin is in short supply. For me to give methotrexate to David, I need to give him lots of IV fluid solutions, including normal saline and dextrose. If you look on the ASHP drug shortage list right now, there's shortages of that. When David gets sick and I want to give him lidocaine rinses, he needs that. If he can't eat and he needs IV nutrition, I need to give him that. But there's shortages of the critical electrolytes and essential minerals in that IV shortages that are in short supply. And I could go on, Sheila, until we're blue in the face. The point is that childhood cancer in particular is affected by these shortages. And as you appreciated, each decade we've done better curing childhood cancer, and these shortages jeopardize that. You take David's disease, ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, that's the most common childhood cancer. It affects almost a quarter of all kids who get cancer. 8 of the 10 drugs that we use to treat and cure ALL have been in short supply over the past 10 years at one point or another. That's shocking. Why do we tolerate it?
Big questions. Yeah. Holly, you told me about one of, I think you called it a side effect, but it seemed really front and center to me, something that David needed because a side effect of some of the treatment is blood clotting, the risk of clots.
Correct. So this scenario really puts in perspective, I believe, how important the medication is just due to the decision that was made for my son who had a severe side effect of one of the chemotherapies, which caused a blood clot in his brain, which then resulted in the loss of function to half of his body. So, and under that circumstance, it was very important through the use of supportive care medication. A shot in his stomach was administered for about 6 months to thin his blood enough to allow to continue that chemotherapy because it was that vital for his prognosis.
And that he needed, do I understand correctly that he had to get the shot in the stomach because another way of administering that wasn't available?
It was the shot in the stomach was a support medication so that he could continue to receive the chemotherapy in a timely manner. So that has always put things in perspective for me that this blood clot in his brain was less important than him continuing on the protocol in a timely manner his chemotherapy medications. So for a patient that cannot access those medications on that day that they need it, it's that impactful.
Dr. Unguru, what do you think is behind these shortages?
Well, the shortages are complicated. There's not one single reason. But if you look at what experts and analysts say, there seems to be consensus that the primary drivers are economic, to a somewhat lesser degree, manufacturing and quality, and maybe some regulatory issues. But the primary driver is economic. In the end of November, I was fortunate to be part of an FDA public meeting in D.C. that was attended by people like me, some clinicians and bioethics folks, industry people from pharma, and a former and current pharmaceutical executive owned the problem. And he said, the only reason that we have drug shortages in the U.S. are economic, management, and financial decisions. And it was encouraging to actually hear somebody. That was Martin Van Trieste, who's the current CEO of a new outfit called Civica RX, which is talking about making low-cost generic drugs. But this is about money. The U.S. owns these drug shortages. Shortages do happen in other countries, but not nearly to the extent or the degree that they happen here. And it's because of our healthcare system and the way that drugs are reimbursed and paid for.
Except in these cases, you would be, I would think, happy to pay more for a reliable supply of these relatively inexpensive drugs. These are not the big, exciting new breakthrough drugs that cost tens of thousands of dollars.
Which are never scarce. I mean, you've hit on a really important point, Sheila. It's these old tried and true drugs that are life-saving and for which we have no alternatives and that are reimbursed relatively cheaply that are in short supply. We do not see shortages of the blockbuster immunotherapy drugs, monoclonal antibodies. I mean, take the really important and innovative and exciting therapy like CAR T-cell, which is a cellular therapy for kids with certain types of relapsed and refractory leukemia. A single dose of the drug is $475,000, and the total cost of administering it is estimated to be over $1 million. Now, that's really important for kids who have bad leukemia, but when we're talking about drugs like vincristine and etoposide and methotrexate and asparaginase that have been around for decades, and they're continually short and reimbursed at dollars per dose.
Holly, how would you summarize the impact that these shortages that you dealt with had on David?
I would say during a very fragile state going through treatment, these children are very isolated as it is, just due to being their immune system being so compressed. It's devastating. As a parent, it's very stressful to know that you're going into a clinic to receive a chemotherapy regimen that you know you've seen on the shortage list days prior. You don't know if it's going to be available. It impacts every day.
How is David doing now?
He's doing great now. He's doing wonderful. Thank you.
He's pretty close to the end of his treatment, right?
Yes, and into this year.
And he's playing lacrosse.
He is. He's an excellent lacrosse player.
I really appreciate your telling us about him. Thank you.
Thank you.
We need to take a short break. Holly Cam Wall is the mother of David, lacrosse player who is about to finish his treatment for leukemia. Dr. Yoram Ungaru is an oncologist at the Children's Hospital at Sinai in Baltimore and a faculty member at the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. He led an effort to develop rationing guidelines for the Children's Oncology Group. After a short break, we're going to talk more about what he thinks needs to be done to address shortages of medicine. And this is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this morning about shortages of life-saving drugs in the U.S., sporadic shortages perhaps, but they've been occurring for more than a decade, and our guest says they're getting worse. He sees these shortages from a particular vantage point. Dr. Yoram Ungaru is a hematologist and oncologist at the Children's Hospital at Sinai. He sees kids fighting cancer who can't get the medications they need. Dr. Ungaru, you've written that in treating childhood cancer, oncologists typically get just one chance at a cure. Why is that?
The biology, the nature of cancer is such that cancer cells are smart and they're devious. And it's kind of like whack-a-mole. If you've ever been down to the ocean and played that game, you have to hit it hard and hit it frequently. And if you think about that game, if you let up for 1 second, those moles, or in this case, the cancer cells, they pop up again and they develop resistance. And so we have treatable and curable diseases that in the absence of having the right amount of drugs can suddenly become resistant and much more difficult to treat.
And so that makes a shortage really scary.
It terrifies us.
Your article in the Journal of American Medical Association Pediatrics cited an economic cost of medication shortages of close to $500 million a year. What goes into that?
And that actually is probably tremendously underestimated. Those costs are related to hospitals and organizations spending time trying to find another place to get drug, many times pharmacists and hospitals will pay extra money to get a drug that's short that's been marked up.
You're also on the faculty of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Do you have to ration drugs to sick children?
Yes, we ration, hospitals ration all the time. When I was here several years ago, we talked about rationing, and our task force, we've talked about ways to prevent and to mitigate these shortages, and the shortages persisted. We then came up with guidelines about how to allocate, ration, prioritize, and the shortages persisted. And now we're publishing these recommendations of creating what we call essential medicines list, of having a constant supply of these drugs. But hospitals do ration. And one of our recommendations in our current work is that we need to be more public. We need to be more transparent. Hospitals shouldn't be embarrassed to let the public know, because that is one of the only ways, I believe, that we're going to hopefully see some change in this, is when patients and patients' families are vocal and share their experiences. Why should we continue to tolerate these preventable shortages?
It's Dr. Yoram Ungeru, an oncologist at the Children's Hospital at Sinai, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about shortages of medications in the U.S. You say it's time for government to step in. And do what?
The government stepped in to bail out Fannie and Freddie. The government stepped in to bail out the auto industry and Wall Street. And the government has to do something more here. We can't continue to rely on the goodwill of drug manufacturers that they're going to solve this problem alone. So what we recommend and what we published is that the government ally with a interested party and have a appropriate supply of drugs at all time. That can be done through incentives. That can be done through subsidies. The government can make its own drug by allying with folks like this. We need to view these drug shortages as a national healthcare emergency, a public health crisis. And by doing that, certain policies can be implemented. And the FDA twice in the past 5 years has actually talked about creating what we're calling for an essential medicines list, but it hasn't happened. And hopefully, through our efforts and efforts of countless other advocates, this may see the light of day. But the government has to do something. I mean, again, I go back to the fact that you have Holly and David, and why should we tolerate that you have a curable disease and we're even risking? Why is that even an option, that we're willing to risk survival or outcome because of a shortage or a potential shortage?
I don't understand how creating a list of essential medicines means they're going to exist.
Great question. The list itself won't. The list is the mechanism of these are the drugs that are deemed essential. And by the way, the World Health Organization has created the original essential medicines list, which includes, among other things, for children, including cancer agents. Just to put this into perspective, the WHO's essential medicines list for cancer for children includes 18 drugs and 4 supportive care drugs. Over the past 2.5 years, 63% of the drugs on that essential medicines list have been in short supply here in the U.S. That's how bad the situation is. So first, we need to create a list. These are the drugs that are important. But by having government actually guarantee that we have these drugs, that they make them, the government makes them in concert with an interested party, that's what the list's purpose is. To say these are the drugs that we need, and this is, and then by offering incentives, subsidies, looking at these issues like a public utility is how, and partnering with an interested party would be how they're made.
I know these shortages are not caused by the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. But the opposition, those who are opposed to Obamacare, often complain that it is too intrusive, too much government.
Mm-hmm.
And we are in a situation where the Trump administration is in federal court arguing that the Affordable Care Act should be completely wiped
abolished.
Out.
Yeah.
So are we at a time when it is realistic to think that the federal government is going to take a more active role in intervening in medical shortages?
As far as the shortages are concerned, I don't see any other way. I mean, we have one of the best healthcare systems in the world. Some people would say the best. How is it that we're also the leader when it comes to drug shortages? Why does this not happen in other places? I would caution any politician. Do they want to have to face David and Holly and tell them that they don't have enough drug to treat their curable cancer? If they want to do that, then government doesn't have to have a role and we'll continue to see them. That's not a conversation that I relish continuing to have on a repeated basis.
I'm grateful to you for talking to us about it. Thank you.
I'm grateful for you wanting to hear us. Thank you.
Dr. Yoram Ungeru is an oncologist at the Children's Hospital at Sinai in Baltimore and a faculty member at the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. More information at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're with us. Hope you'll come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.